residential school agreement to our people, making them remember can cause them more trauma and make them sick, right? There's not, it's not enough time to heal. You know, they, yes, they have these healing funds, but who's it for, really? You know, is it for those elders who are not willing to engage in counseling, who don't have the time, they're just trying to survive and make it to the next year or so, or the, you know, like, it's really devastating.
You know, I think the ones of my age group, I'll be 72 this year, I think we were pretty much the last ones that were given that knowledge of our territory, given that knowledge of how our families functioned, how our clans functioned, who was responsible, how, and what Stephen's saying here. Okay, my sister on one side, like my biological sister is my sister, but I use the same term, like my mother was one of 12 women in that clan. So all 12 of them I'd call mother. And the children of those 12 women are all my brothers and sisters. And we have a term for older brother, older sister. And then when we get to my father's side of the family, those are not my cousins. They're Tawi. We're so close related that we can joke with each other real hard, but we can't get mad. Now that's the side I can marry because I'm eagle and they're raven. So many people don't know how this system works, and many of the ones of my age don't talk about it, because unfortunately many of them were taken as children. And what you're saying, Gnarji, was that the original ones that were put into the school, they were the ones that bore the brunt of it. And so it took about four or five generations to where you had enough of a foundation of messed up people that start messing up their own kids. And they didn't have to do as much to the kids anymore.
One of the things that I noticed too, Woody, when I went to one of our negotiating meetings with the Tawitsis band, that it was the Mumtagela who were the original people from Turner Island, along with the Tawitsis people. They amalgamated some years ago and built this totem pole. There's an amalgamation pole. But they've been cut out of the treaty process, being told that they no longer exist, right? These are the people that know their language. I've witnessed them speaking up against the chief negotiator time and time again and being shut down time and time again and told that they didn't know what they were talking about. When in actuality, because they know the language and the original language of our people, they are the ones that know the original territory, and that is what is so dangerous about people speaking the language.
it's another song in this key. Yeah, but this one's about me. I may not want to hear the words to G.
Hi, welcome to the June 26th Arts Report on CITR 101.9 FM. This evening I'll fill you in on my trip to the H.R. McMillan Space Center to see the current production of You Are Very Star, and we'll play part two of our interview with writer Kevin Kerr. We also have SFU Professor Patricia Grubin talking about the installation The Veil of Nature, Museum of Liminal Science, and the accompanying play, The Secret Doctrine, and I'll report back from the 31st Annual Jesse Awards, and much more. Hi, I'm your host for this evening, Sarah Lapsley. My voice is back. Yay! It's kind of quiet around the sub-building these days. Students are off, but we have some amazing live broadcasts coming up over the summer. The first one is at the Folk Festival coming up in July. So we're looking forward to that. I just want to shout out to the show that's on directly prior to mine from 4 to 5, and it's called Snowaeolf, and the host is Gunargi. So it's a Coast Salish show. And in Coast Salish, Snowaeolf is the word for teachings or laws. And so the host is an Aboriginal elder who grew up in a residential school, and we know of the continuing damage that that experience has caused many people. But he has great stories to tell and a lot of wisdom, and it's a great privilege to hear the endangered sort of language spoken. It's really a beautiful language. So he often shares wonderful ways of the Aboriginal people. I often sit in here and kind of write stuff down. So tune in every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. It's just before the Arts Report. It's syndicated, actually, from Co-op Radio. So you could Google their show on the Co-op Radio site. Last week, I played the North Carolina band Superchunk in anticipation of Sled Island. And what happened? The floods came and Sled Island was canceled. I was watching some of the flood coverage live on the internet. It was really unbelievable. But apparently some bands like just drove up to Edmonton and a promoter guy like put some venues on and people played. So the show went on in some kind of form. So that's great. But we've got lots to cover today. So let's get into it right here, right now. So You Are Very Star. Last week I talked about it and we played a bit from writer Kevin Kerr. So I went on Sunday. I give it an A+. It was definitely a great experience and one that I recommend. At the same time, there are things I kind of resented about it. Like, it's not for the lazy, passive consumer of art. They make you interact. So when you get your tickets, they send you a link with instructions that, quote, invite you to immerse yourself in the experience before you even go. So it says the show doesn't begin when you walk through the doors at the H.R. McMillan Space Center. The show is now. So they recommend that you begin this endeavor as soon as possible so you have the opportunity to explore and investigate in the coming days before your scheduled performance. I'm sorry, I just don't want to do any of that. I spend enough time on the computer and it just feels like homework. And their description of what you were going to explore wasn't that intriguing. And there was like no prize or anything. So when I got there, there was this cadre of sweet indie rock volunteers who gave us instructions. Like, you can't go in the theater, you have to wait. They give you this treasure map to use during the intermission. that we had to stand in a line and file into the theater. And so we had to stand on this metal plate and say our names, and it recorded our names or something. And then they made us sit in the first three rows. Like, no, you can't just chill out, like, in the back. You have to sit in the front. And I just knew where this was going. Like, they're going to make us interact and we'll be forced to engage. So I started to feel resentful. Like, this is my Sunday afternoon, you know. But then it started. And it was downstairs in the older theater, a very simple set, 1960s. Like, it was like a classroom. And there was this projection that would flash, like, the time, like 1968. But then the narrative unfolded backwards. So they'd do a scene, and then it'd be like, flash 10 minutes earlier. And they'd do another scene, like, 2 weeks prior. And so this troubled me because I'm kind of a linear thinker and sort of easily confused. So I was having trouble getting it. But by the end, I kind of pieced the narrative together, and then I appreciated, you know, they made me work for it. And it sort of forced you to enjoy the vignettes in the present moment. But the story is like this professor, played by a great actor, Michael Rinaldi. So he's a young prof teaching a creative writing class. There might be something I missed by not signing in and exploring beforehand, because the lady behind me was like laughing super loudly and I didn't get it. But I warmed up for sure. And the prof is quite misguided, and he's sort of in love with all his female students, and he writes them these letters. He's got a lot of spiritual hubris. He wants to be a guru and save the world, sort of pursues these higher states of consciousness, and he sort of overwhelms others with his amazing insights and his poetry. Other students in the class are like, can we please, like, say our poems? And he doesn't want to give up the floor. His nemesis is the dean of the department, Earl Burney, and Earl Burney's like sort of outwardly more staid, like he wears a suit, but he wins the students over with his charisma and he's interested in them. And the actor who plays Earl is actually a woman, Patty Allen. She did an amazing job portraying a man. Her performance was definitely one of the highlights. There's also this feminist artist, this beautiful African-American character who stands up to the pompous prof, and her name is Marcia Regis. That's the actor, and I'm going to talk about her more later. At first, it seemed kind of amateurish. The dialogue was kind of like wooden, and I couldn't suspend my disbelief because I was like right in the front row. But the professor really carried it with these hilarious one-liners, and he drinks ayahuasca in front of the class, and he's wearing this sort of bright orange paisley muumuu. Although the muumuu was like the centerpiece of some fat jokes, and I really never find those funny, but the muumuu itself was funny. So as the audience, we were involved to the extent that we were like sort of the class. We were the class members. Thankfully, it wasn't more than that. Like, you're sitting in the front and the actor's quite close and you're like, oh my God, don't look at me. Like, don't make me do something. But overall, the first act was called Part One, Orbiting the Cusp of Greatness. And it really grew on me. Like, I liked the vibe, the set. I kind of finally got a handle on the story. And really what I took away was the professor's spiritual hubris and this all-too-human need to transcend the limits of ordinary life and this impossible craving to be the center of the universe. So then it was intermission, and we're supposed to engage in this treasure hunt. Like, we had this map to little stations where we're supposed to do an activity, but I'm, like, quite spatially disabled, and I looked at the map and just, like, blanked. I'm like, I don't even know. I can't read this map. I didn't know where to start and what to do. So I just kind of wandered from station to station, and there were funny little kind of artsy activities, like a tent stuffed with animals, and you're supposed to take one. But the instructions were sometimes ambiguous and extra confusing, because you were either like a bird or a rocket, and like you had to do different things depending on whether you're a bird or a rocket. There are about 15 altogether, 12 altogether. I visited just a few. There was one where you had to dial a phone number, which I guess would trigger a return call in your cell. And I was like, no, I don't want to answer the phone. I'm not a phone person. In the end, I think I visited three or four, but I did enjoy them. Like, you had to type on a typewriter or pick a message out of a big bowl and pin it up. Mine said, astronaut in love. I think the idea is that the intermission represents the current time of 2013. The first act is like set in 1968. It was fun, great little stations, like this old vintage jukebox. I think if they had less, like people might have gotten around to all of them, because you need to pee in the intermission, kind of chill, process the first act. The best part was getting my picture taken in a spacesuit. But, you know, so I didn't get through all. Some keeners actually got through all, and I think they did win a prize. But I just want to play, before I talk about Act 2, I want to play a bit more of my Kevin Kerr interview, because he talks more. He wrote Act 2, and he sort of talks about his influences growing up and his sort of love of space. So here he is.
Is there any particular influence in terms of space that you had growing up or that captivated you about space?
Yeah. Well, I did. I mean, that building has a kind of a history for me in terms of my childhood memories and such. I grew up actually in Kamloops. I was born in Vancouver, but we moved when I got into school. But we would go back all the time. And so as a kid, I remember going to the planetarium, seeing shows there. And just loving the experience of I found it really beautiful, sort of almost overwhelming space, and that very kind of dreamy space where you'd walk into this room, this enormous dome, and clear blue sky and clouds floating on the ceiling, and it was like being, you know, you're in a room that contained the sky, and then it would turn into, you know, the night star field, and it just found that to be so kind of magical and overwhelming and beautiful. And so that dreamlike quality really impressed upon me, I think. And something I like about live performance is that it has a dreamlike quality in the theater. When you go in to see a play and the lights go down, suddenly you find yourself in a scene, just kind of like the way a dream just sort of materializes as you fall asleep, and then you're in some place. You know there's a backstory, you kind of sense that there's something that's happened before, but you don't have access to it. You just catch up midway, and then it moves along for a period of time, and then it dissolves upon waking, and that's the quality of being in the theater, similar to that. And I was a kid that loved, you know, space and reading about space exploration and astronauts and fantasized all about that. And so, you know, as a kid, we had books around the house on, you know, the Apollo missions and all that, or that kind of golden age of space exploration. And then I remember getting up really early and watching the first space shuttle launches. And being captivated by the next wave of space exploration, and, you know, being really affected emotionally when the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded in 86.
Yeah.
Teacher Krista McCall was killed. And that moment was, for me, a really romantic moment, that they sent a first-time civilian up into space. And this teacher was going to be up with the astronauts, and she'd be able to kind of give us a real, more human view of the whole thing, and it kind of looked like a door opening to kind of, you know, everybody kind of could have access. And so that was a major, you know, kind of tragic moment and feeling of being kind of losing something big there for a while. But then right now I'm really loving the fact that the romanticism that's kind of been revived with Chris Hadfield up in space. I love that this Canadian's totally made space cool and sexy again, and that he's playing David Bowie in the space station and all that. And I think so it's kind of neat. It's a neat timing to be kind of back in there, and the building for me is a real mix of nostalgia and dreaming about the future.
That was Kevin Kerr, who was a contributing writer to You Are Very Star. And I'm just going to, he wrote the second act, and that was called Part 2, Transcendence. So we got to then go to a different theater, which was upstairs. The big theater is like stupendous, amazing. Like it's this huge dome, this huge room with like these theater seats in this huge circle, and they're sort of permanently reclined. So you're looking up kind of into the sky. It's a huge dome, and they project onto the dome. And I think it likely retracts to look at the stars in the summer. So they projected a few different things, and like, Wow, it was amazing. So the next part is loosely related to the first part, but it takes place in 2048. And I was like trying to calculate how old I'd be then. Pretty old, if alive at all. Ugh. But in this, the professor seems to have gotten his wish and led this sort of transcendence movement. And some humans have converted to this augmented form. And so they're completely living in a virtual reality. The professor is like immobile physically, and he's just kind of a brain hooked up to a computer. And his brain does kind of like run the universe. And so all the costumes are white, and they're wearing these kind of visors, like those chilling Google visors that are coming out. And there are projections on the stage that sort of reflect what they're seeing in their minds. Really cool set. And I think the dialogue in this part, written by Kevin Kerr, was better written, more meaningful, like meatier. And what the characters describe their reality being like is sort of like the ability to be everywhere at once and to know everything, kind of like this high-speed internet experience, but just kick it up like a thousand notches so everything's whizzing by. They can't even relate to regular humans anymore. Like, to formulate a sentence takes too much time. A linear thought is not fast enough or gratifying enough. It sort of gives you this unpleasant taste of what our minds could become. So needing constant stimulation. So this human comes onto the scene, and she used to know the professor, so she's an old lady. Previously, this lady played Earl Burney, but she's a different character in 2048. And there's some amazing dialogue as the old lady tries to communicate with the professor's daughter, who is an augmented human. And the daughter has no social skills, and she can't relate. Like, she's trying to formulate. She wants to be welcoming to the old lady, but she can't even, like, she doesn't, can't even hold a conversation. But the old lady talks to the professor, and he doesn't say anything, but she touches him and talks about old memories and nostalgia, and his consciousness starts to change, and he sort of unplugs and disappears. And because he's kind of like God, so when he becomes unplugged, all the augmented humans become unplugged, and so some sort of hilarity ensues and kind of body whatever stuff. Like, they're trying to hug each other, but they have no sense of their own bodies, so they kind of mush it up wrong. And they feel so alone outside of their busy virtual world. It was really cool, that part. I think it probably should have wrapped up there, but then some other things happened. And then this film played with like a country singer in it, Rusty Ford. I guess he's a real country singer. But I think he's supposed to represent a relic of the current time, 2013. And all the little installations that you'd worked on in the intermission were in the film, so it sort of makes sense. And then he sings a country song. But he does say one wise thing about the meaning of life that I really liked. He said, "We're just here to enjoy the view." And it sort of ends when this huge apparatus rises out of the stage, and it's like, whoa, this giant robotic thing, but kind of 60s. And it turns out it's the old analog projector that they've used since the beginning at the H.R. Macmillan Space Center, and it's due to be replaced this summer by a digital system. So actually, you can read more about it on their websites. But overall, there's some great themes here, like sort of a hero's journey for the professor. And I do like the nonlinear thing and the two different stages, getting to experience it. And worth it to just get up in the Space Center, some great dialogue. I really liked it. I think the writing clearly placed itself in Vancouver and in the Space Center, and I think it kind of limits it, like, it doesn't generalize to other venues, but great acting, excuse me, so much work went into this, and all the volunteers like really pulling together to give the audience a really interesting live experience. So I'd say it's definitely worth going just to support the arts, do something different. If you're a 20-something person on psychedelic drugs, I think you'll love it. Definitely the themes of spiritual hubris and transcendence and the danger of sort of, quote, what the internet is doing to our brains. And I love all the galactic stuff. Galactic. Love saying that. So you still have time to see it. You Are Very Star, the H.R. Macmillan Space Center. It's on until June 29th. So that's at 8 p.m. Tuesday to Sunday, I guess, ending on the Saturday night. So go see it. I highly endorse it. And I just want to play a song. And it's by The Church, one of my favorite bands, and it's called Song in Space.
I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my dreams. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
Hi, we're back. Technical problem with that. I will deal with that later. Dead air, sorry. This is Sarah Lapsley. This is CITR 101.9 FM. Just wanted to touch base. I talked to Connie Coons last month about The Call of the Open Road and her photography exhibit, True Nature's Child. Some really beautiful photographs at Chernoff Fine Arts. So that show's been extended to July 6th. So you might want to check out chernofffineart.com for more details. So I think the closing party is July 4th. So definitely check that out. And I wanted to talk about Carmen. So UBC Opera presents Carmen by Georges Bizet, and we really wanted to cover it, but that didn't work out. I still might go see it, but I'm quite exhausted from going to arts events. But it's in French, and Nancy Hermiston is the director. Leslie Dalla is the conductor. So it's set in 19th century Seville, Spain, and it tells the story of a seductive gypsy and her tragic love affair with the vulnerable corporal Don Jose. So it shocked its earliest audiences, I don't know why, but it's since proven to be a masterpiece and a cornerstone of operatic repertoire. So I bet it'll be really good. So it's the UBC opera students, but they're amazing. Like, by the time they even get to UBC, they're incredible performers. So I think you should definitely go see it. It's June, runs tomorrow, the 27th, the 28th, and the 29th at 7:30 p.m., and then Sunday, the 30th at 2 p.m. So if you can check out the, just Google Carmen into the UBC, search it on ubc.ca. So the aria from Carmen is sort of the most recognizable aria. It's called Habanera, and it's that translates. It's the Habanera is the popular name. The true name is L'amour est un oiseau rebelle. So love is a rebellious bird, and it's sort of the entrance aria as Carmen comes in. It's a mezzo soprano role. And I liked some of the words. So in English, it says, "When will I love you? Good Lord, I don't know. Maybe never, maybe tomorrow, but not today, that's for sure. Love is a rebellious bird that none can tame, and it is well in vain that one calls it. If it suits him to refuse, nothing to be done, threat or prayer. The one talks well, the other is silent, and it's the other that I prefer. He says nothing, but he pleases me. The bird you hope to catch beat its wings and flew away. Love is far. You can wait for it. You no longer await it. There it is, all around you, swift, swift. It comes, goes, and then it returns. You think to hold it fast. It flees you. You think to flee it. It holds you." Isn't that nice? I'm going to play it for you. This is a Romanian singer. Her name is Angela Georgiou, and I'm just going to play it. It's Habanera, the aria, the entrance aria of Carmen. So do go see it at UBC, please. Si ricovia de refuser, io ne femmina soprir, lo parlo via l'autre sete, se l'autre que je prefere, in l'aria di me s'il me
Prague. AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the Food Bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Hi, we're back. This is CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to the Arts Report. I'm Sarah Lapsley. So I wanted to talk to you about an amazing thing called the Veil of Nature, Museum of Liminal Science, and an accompanying play called The Secret Doctrine. So it was total synchronicity. Like, I was leaving last week. I was so sick, and I'm like, oh my God, I have to do it next week, and I don't know what to do. And I saw this poster, and I was like, oh my God, like, this is so exciting. It's totally up my alley. And it turned out Patricia Grubin, who's the sort of writer of the play and a collaborator on the art installation, said she had made this arduous journey up to UBC and had to get parked, which everyone knows is a nightmare around here, and she wasn't sure it was worth it. And I was like, so grateful that she made the trip. So it's a collaborative project, Associate Professor Patricia Grubin and Music Professor Martin Gottfried, as well as some other people. They wanted to explore the threshold between rational science and intuition. And they could only go so far in the play. Now, the play is sort of a biography of Helena Blavatsky, and she was an occultist, a 19th century occultist, very famous. So in the play, a scientist sort of decides to check out her claims of her paranormal abilities. And so the installation allows visitors to experience for themselves some of the questions that Blavatsky posed. So you need to go see the installation and then the play. You need to see both. I just, like, out of everything, you know, I've covered, this has been my favorite thing. So what you do is you go to the installation and you enter a site and sort of a room within the room, and it's inspired by the Cavendish Physics Lab at Cambridge University circa 1885. On the cusp of great discoveries in particle physics. So you sort of find this interactive cabinet of wonders that transports you to an interior universe. And so, yeah, it's really amazing. I want to let Patricia tell you about it and explain the play, but I went yesterday and she's like, this is going to be like a facial, like that good. And I was like, oh, yeah. And it was like, I just love that sense of going back in time and the sense of escape. And they give you a little white lab coat with a little notebook in the arm pocket, so it adds to the feeling. And that, you know, I'm keeping secrets back here to encourage you to go. There's so much to this installation. On the outside of the kind of room is like this chalkboard surface where there's all these mathematical formulas written, and you go in, it's dark, and this ambient music is playing, and there's old books and little old vials and notebooks that students or professors have written in observations, these funny kind of antique apparatuses, one that's like crackling and making electricity. Then you go further and there's a station with crystals and fossils, sort of more of like a natural sciences stuff, then a rock with a Sanskrit inscription. And then a little table with an antique lamp where you can sit and think. And this beautiful incense is burning. And some other kind of tricks and projections and music. But I miss them because I was so busy writing in my notebook. But go to the installation and then go to the play. But I'm just going to let Patricia tell you about it. She's quite an amazing person. She founded the Praxis sort of film society. She's a professor at the School for Contemporary Arts. She's a filmmaker. Looks like she's done some amazing stuff. She publishes a lot. She's just wrote a book chapter about Adam Egoyan. So here she is talking about The Veil of Nature, Museum of Liminal Science.
So tell me again sort of how the idea evolved with your colleague in Toronto.
This project started about 10 years ago as an idea for a screenplay. So I wrote the screenplay. It's set in the late 1800s. It's about real people, most notably Helena Blavatsky, who was the founder of the Theosophical Society, the first sort of international New Age movement. And she was a very controversial figure. So there's a lot of wonderful stuff to write a play about. It's set mostly in India. It's about her paranormal phenomena and or her claims to be able to produce paranormal phenomena. So we, at some point a few years ago, I decided to turn it into a stage play. And at that point, I started thinking a lot about how what Blavatsky did was very much the same as what theater does. It takes an illusion and uses that illusion to find some kind of deeper truth. So we wanted to make the play interactive in some way, or to allow people the sort of psychic space to go through the kinds of experience that people in the Theosophical Society wanted to do and did, you know, meditating and that sort of thing. And there was just really no way to do it in a play that has to keep moving, and you've got a very diverse audience. Some people might like to have a moment of stillness, and some people might be very impatient. So while I was grappling with all that as the playwright, I started thinking, why don't we have something else that's like a space within the play, but it's a space that, instead of watching actors on a stage, you can go in and become the actor yourself, but in privacy, so that you have an experience that's as long or as short as you want it to be. So that's where the idea of doing an installation came from. And the play is funded by a grant. We said in the grant application that we would also be doing the installation on a website, and then the play just sucked up all the money, so we had to go find some more money to do the installation. But thanks to BC Film and the BC Arts Council, we got a little extra money to build that thing.
Mm-hmm. So the installation's like a science sort of laboratory. So how does it tie in with Blavatsky specifically?
The story in the play, which is more or less a true story, is about the investigation of Blavatsky. to see if her paranormal phenomena had any kind of basis in science. So this was just before the electron was discovered, just before X-rays were discovered. People really were on the verge of a lot of these huge revolutionary breakthroughs in physics that happened just a few years later. But they hadn't happened yet. And so spiritualists and other people were being tested and investigated by organizations like the Society for Psychical Research, which included a lot of respected scientists. And so the character in our play, who's really the main character of the play, is a young physicist who works at Cambridge University. And he hooks up with the Society for Psychical Research and goes to India to find out if there's anything, you know, some wave or force or something that she's able to control that explains some of these, you know, teleportation and things that, mm-hmm. that she was doing.
And did they find something? Like, did they come to any conclusions? Oh, yes.
You'll have to either come see the play or check it out on Wikipedia to
yeah.
get the answer.
Yeah. No, I want to come see the play.
A lot of people still believe that she was able to do uncanny things. A lot of people believe that she was a complete fraud.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people believe that she was somewhere in between, that sometimes she could do things and sometimes she tricked people.
She was quite a prolific writer,
yes.
if I recall, and I've looked at it many years ago, but it seemed like quite meaty, her writings.
Her writing is very dense, and mm-hmm. it's drawn from a lot of Hindu religious texts and Buddhist philosophy and Gnostic and Hermetic stuff from Egypt and Greece and so it's, some people think it's kind of the hodgepodge. It's, you have to read it all as metaphor, you know, that people read things into it, and one of the things that they read into it is, and one of the things she talked about a lot, is how this was a new way of looking at science. And if Western science would only study these teachings, there's a quote which we put at the end of the play. It's like, in a few years, a rent will be made in the veil of nature, which is where the title of the installation comes from. A rent will be made in the veil of nature, and material science will receive a death blow. So what she meant by material science is the notion that the atom is a little particle of matter that is stable, and if you put enough of these particles together, you get a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we now know that that's not really how the universe operates at all, although we still function in our daily lives as if it does.
Mm-hmm.
We still feel, if I hit that door, I'd hurt my knuckles, when really what makes up that door is way more space than matter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really something that we're exploring in the installation, and people explore it each in their own way along that kind of continuum between total rationality and total intuition.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, like, liminality or liminal, which is part of the title, is really one of my favorite words. And so what does that mean to you, and sort of what does it mean in the context of the play or the installation?
In the installation, you're literally crossing a threshold, because it's a box. You think you're walking into a cube that might be a classroom or a lab or something. That's the intention. And you open the door and you go inside and you close the door, and you've crossed into a different kind of a space with its own set of guidelines, I guess. I started thinking about Alice in Wonderland, which I guess is a, you know, it's so familiar to us now, and yet really it's based on mathematical theory, a lot of it, and those kinds of absurd sets that Dodgson, the writer, was, was a mathematician. And so the idea that we talked about the idea of sort of going down a rabbit hole in a way, and there were some things you think you can control that you can't control, some things you can control, and other things you know you can't control. It's in the way that Alice, you know,
or you don't even know if you can control it or if it exists, or I don't know. Yeah. No, it's wonderful. So some of the objects, are they real historical artifacts? Like I'm thinking when you come in, you first come in and there's those little test tube and strange machines. Where did you get those? And
my favorite one, the one that we just got working yesterday, and I actually haven't even been through it with this thing working, but it's in the first station, and it's called a Crookes Radiant Matter Tube. It was actually the crucial piece of apparatus that was used in the discovery of the electron, because they passed a magnet over it and found that the rays were bent in a certain way that indicated there were particles with some kind of negative charge that couldn't be explained any other way. So that is something that it's important in our play also, and that's a real Crookes tube. It's not really 100 years old, but they still make them, and they're often used in high school physics classes. So, but the power supply for the Crookes tube is 100 years old. And I found a wonderful man from Ithaca, New York, who builds replicas of old scientific equipment for collectors. So he sent us the power supply. He's got a big barn full of old wires, and you know, there are a lot of people who are into this kind of steampunk stuff.
Yeah,
they like to build these things and collect them.
Oh wow! I liked the. Because it was very sort of science-y, but then further along, there's these fossils and crystals and the Sanskrit kind of inscription. So what's that about in the context of?
I don't want to be too explicit about it, because okay. I would like people to come and see it, but I'll just say that in my own work as a filmmaker, someone pointed out to me once that it's all about the impossibility of knowing for sure. And so with this project, Marion first came up with the idea of the shape of it, which I don't want to describe because I want people to discover that. But once we had that shape, we started talking about devolution, in a way, about going backward from a sort of a rational, as we put it in that first shelf, it's the science you can see. You can look through a microscope. You can observe things using this apparatus, but they're the kinds of things that people observed in the mid-19th century. And then as you travel along, you get more into the realm of the invisible. So it's still science in the second station, but it's things that you can't just, they're not just magnified, they're transformed in some way. And in the third station, we're starting to break down our rational thought and even our sense of language.
Mm-hmm. So
So what are you hoping people will get out of it? Like, obviously it provides some context for the play, it sounds like, or an additional experience in the play, but what else do you hope they'll get out of it?
I would like to think that people can come in here as a kind of a respite from their day and just go through some kind of a transformation, however brief, you know, to recognize the uncanniness of the universe around us, really.
Yeah, it really was that, like entering this different universe for a few blissful minutes.
You know, we were working on it so intensely in the last few days, we didn't even really have time to test it before people started going through it, and it was all just speculative as to how it would, you know, because it's about how do you feel when you're in it, and so we've tweaked it a little bit over the last week, but I was just reading the comments, and I'm so happy to read that people without any prompting from us, because we don't even know them, are writing about that that experience they have in the way, exactly the way I hoped they would.
That was Patricia Grubin talking about the Veil of Nature Museum of Liminal Science. So that's an art installation. It's on in room 2205 at the Gold Core Center for the Arts. And the play, The Secret Doctrine, runs July 2nd to 6th, also at the Gold Core Center. And they have an amazing award-winning actress, Gabrielle Rose, playing Helena Blavatsky. And I'd like to talk more about her, but we're just almost out of time, as usual. I wanted to talk about the 31st Jesse Richardson Theater Awards. It was at the Commodore, and it was filled with beautiful men and women dressed in their finest. And I'm not that familiar with the theater scene yet. So I just relaxed with a cranberry soda and enjoyed the show. So they were a very enthusiastic crowd and just so excited to be out and celebrating their community. And they're actors, so they know how to put on a good show, like little skits and lights, the slick MC, lots of in-jokes that I didn't get. I was kind of fuming. Like, I've never won a prize. Actually, the only prize I've ever won is like a pound of raw chicken at the Legion meat draw. That was quite a while ago now. For real, that's true. But lots of great skits, and they had, the best one was this sort of handsome actor did this Shakespeare monologue, and then four directors from the Bard Theater Society, Carousel Theater, Arts Club Theater, and Pi Theater each try to pitch him on why this actor should join their theater company. So very self-deprecating and a real laugh as they played sort of on the stereotypes of their individual companies. I saw our own Brian Cochran. I don't think he recognized me, but he was our public service announcement guy last year. He worked here. He got his MFA in directing from UBC, and he voiced many of our PSAs. And so you can still hear him often on the ads that we still play. So he looked very cute in a little bow tie. He's engaged to be married, so congratulations, Brian. I did some taping at the show, but the audio just wasn't there. There was this guy, and he was like the James Franco of the night, like the presenter. He had this bowler hat, and he was like drinking beer, pretty obnoxious and not funny, and like trying to edge out the other guy. It was like fail. But last year, people went on too long with their winning speeches, so they made this big deal of announcing that a little gong would go sound if people went on too long. Thankfully, nobody did. But the winner of the Best Supporting Actress gave an endearing but slightly hysterical speech that ended with this sort of inspirational spiel that made me think of that dreadful I Believe song from the Olympics. But no, she was beautiful and wonderful. And one of the winners said he was happy because all he ever wanted was to be recognized by his peers. And isn't that true? Like, we just want other people that are doing the same thing to appreciate our contribution. And it was inspiring, like all these creative people, so passionate. And as they pointed out, like Vancouver Live Theater, you know, it's not about the money, it's about the love. Now, I saw the woman from You Are Very Star, Marcia Regis. And she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress in her performance for David Mamet's play Race. And she was, like, so gorgeous. She had her hair, like, all puffed out, and she had this beautiful shimmery kind of dove gray dress on. And she is, like, a superstar. So amazing. She has massive star power. She didn't win, and I was quite crushed. But you can check her out online, marciaregis.net. And I found out that she's also a personal trainer, and you can check that out at pulsefitness.ca. And I was like, if she was my trainer, I'd so do, like, whatever she wanted. Like, she was born in Haiti, moved to Canada, and now lives in Vancouver, so I wish her luck in her career. And so I hope to see many more plays in the coming year, and so I can have a better idea next year if I go again and maybe get some clips. So it was nice to go out and enjoy the Commodore and watch people celebrating their passion. So I was contacted, just a last announcement of something going on. I was contacted by this artist, Matt Bowen, and he wanted to send us some material to promote his opening tomorrow night. And I was like, okay. But actually, when he sent it, I was really blown away. I think it's going to be a great show. And so it's large portraits of people using this sort of bright color palette, like hot pinks and oranges and yellows and electric blues. And they almost look like professional models, kind of like an American Apparel ad, but really high quality photographs. They're really interesting because he's superimposed these animated bolts of lightning. And he describes the bolts of lightning as a tiny bolt of inspiration, exposure to new experiences, and an invitation to increase the breadth of your vision. So my favorite character in the portraits is this cute guy in a visor, and he's holding cassette tapes with the lightning bolt on them and this colorful kind of vintage cassette player. So definitely something for the collection. Like, I would like to have one of these in my collection, my non-existent collection. And there's also some animated prints featuring the lightning motif with a pop art feel, and there's one that's like a fake Cosmopolitan magazine cover. It's almost kind of like Arkham and addressing the issues of, you know, the domination of sort of skinny as a beauty ideal. On his site, you can see more examples of his pop art drawing and poster art at mwbowen.com. Very talented guy. Opening reception, 8 p.m. Thursday, June 27th, that's tomorrow, at Kafka's at 2525 Main Street. Now, we're just wrapped up, but I want to say the lightning bolts in his art make me think of Zeus, or the god of thunder, and that makes me think of Kiss. And I was so sad because it looked like I was going to be able to get an interview with Paul Stanley of Kiss. They're playing a string of sort of small BC towns starting very soon, including Vancouver on July 6th. So CITR got an email from their publicist, and it was like, do you guys want to interview Paul? And I had like a complete meltdown. I was like, I'll do anything for this interview. Praying, I said affirmations, I read Kiss bios, but sadly it was kind of like a blanket email, and then they're kind of business minded, so they're only doing select interviews and undoubtedly tying in their endless promotions. If you're a fan and you have $1,500 to waste, you can get a special VIP package, which is like a meet and greet, free t-shirts, and you know, good seats, and like your picture taken with Gene Simmons. So to assuage my disappointment, and to help process my grief at not being able to interview Paul Stanley, and in lieu of my interview, I'm going to play a fun song. It's not your typical CITR fare, but it's definitely not a hit. And that's what counts. We can't play hits. It wasn't even released. And it's called It's Not Smoke. And it was an unreleased song they recorded in 1976. I don't know why they didn't release it, because it's a great rockin' song. So I'm going to leave you with that. Kiss, It's Not Smoke. Megan, our lovely Arts Report co-host, will be back next week. I don't know what she'll have in store, but I know it'll be awesome as usual. I'll be back on July 10th. So here it is. Kiss, If It's Smoke, goodbye and good night.
I know better when I'm Bye.